Much more than a meal, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Trump's budget would slash spending on many programs, including Meals on Wheels. Elderly Koreans in one Queens neighborhood would really feel that cut.
It really provides such an intangible service in terms of the connection they have to another human during the day. It's so much more than just, you know, delivering food.
Plus, a young woman in Brooklyn remembers when she was just 10 and her father gave her an ultimatum.
My dad was like, if we can't control you, then we're going to get you married. As a kid back then, I remember staying quiet.
And some advice on dealing with North Korea.
Picture a robber who walks up to you, points a gun at his own head, and says, stop or I'll shoot.
That's all ahead here on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're tuned to The World. Busy day at the White House. German Chancellor Angela Merkel was there today for her first face-to-face meeting with President Trump. We'll have more on that later in the show. But let's start now with a closer look at one line in Trump's proposed federal budget, the one that would slash funding for the Meals on Wheels program. It's got a lot of people wondering, why cut a program that delivers meals to homebound elderly people? Trump Budget Director Mick Mulvaney's answer yesterday, Meals on Wheels doesn't work.
I can't defend that anymore. We cannot defend that anymore. We're $20 trillion in debt.
One who disagrees with that logic is Linda Lee. She's Executive Director of Korean Community Services of New York, a group that delivers 150 meals to homebound seniors every day.
We have about three trucks that go out and deliver the 150 meals every day. And our head cook at the senior center, she herself is a senior. She's 90 years old. She's Korean. And her and her staff get to the senior center around 6:30 in the morning. And that's when they start preparing all of the homebound meals.
And what kind of things does she make every day?
The typical meal consists of some sort of meat, whether that's beef, chicken, fish, or maybe tofu. And then it usually comes with kimchi, which is, you know, the pickled cabbage. That's very traditional in Korean food, along with another vegetable side dish, as well as rice, a soup, a piece of fruit, as well as a carton of milk.
What's at stake for Korean seniors without this service?
Aside from the actual nutrition that they receive from these meals, it really provides such an intangible service in terms of the connection they have to another human during the day. It's so much more than just, you know, delivering food. You know, oftentimes the drivers are the only ones that they come into contact with throughout the day. The drivers have really great relationships with the clients that they deliver the meals to. And it's a way for them to also check up on the seniors, make sure that everything is okay, that there's something else that they need. And also to make sure that they're, you know, answering the doors and physically well. If it weren't for the drivers coming daily, we wouldn't be able to find out about health emergencies during the course of that 24 hours.
And your drivers are, of course, Korean as well.
Yes. Most of them are first generation, meaning they immigrated here from Korea. And they themselves are seniors, actually. And they do speak the language, which is super helpful when it comes to the clients that we serve.
Why is it important to have a Meals on Wheels specifically for the Korean community?
I think it's important because they're able to eat the foods that they've grown up with their entire lives. And actually what we've seen happen is some of the clients that we cannot serve, we actually refer them out to other mainstream agencies where they get American food or frozen food. And what ends up happening is that they just don't eat it. And if they don't eat the food, their nutrition drops. I mean, it's devastating. But also I think that one meal that is culturally competent to them makes them feel still connected in some way.
And what was your reaction today when you heard that Meals on Wheels may be cut if what the president wants in his budget goes through?
My heart sank. And the reason why is because, you know, I feel like oftentimes seniors are left out. They're forgotten about. And we want them to age well. We want them to be honored for all of the things that they've done for us.
I've read that it's a possibility that the money that President Trump is trying to save by cutting budgets like for Meals on Wheels could be used to build a border wall in Mexico. What would be your reaction to that?
I don't even know what to say to that. I will fight tooth and nail to make sure that doesn't happen. Our community members may be labeled as so-called quote-unquote immigrants. You know, they are citizens. They've been here for many, many years. And they contribute to this society as much as anyone else does. And so I think we need to make sure we take care of people living in our own country before we're concerned about building a wall to Mexico. I don't know.
Linda Lee is Executive Director of Korean Community Services of New York. It's based in Queens. Her group delivers 150 meals a day to homebound Korean seniors through their Meals on Wheels program. Thanks a lot, Linda.
Thank you so much.
We stay in New York for this next story. It's about a problem you might think exists only outside the U.S., child marriage. But yes, it happens in New York City and in other communities across the U.S. as well. That's because archaic laws haven't been updated. World's Jasmine Garst has our story.
When she was 10 years old, Safia Majabin started skipping school. And here's what she'd do. She'd ride the New York City subways aimlessly.
I just love riding the train. You ride from one end to the other end, and then you go back. And then you, get out a few stops and just explore some stations are just really beautiful.
For Safia, this was a rare taste of freedom. She came from a very strict, very tight-knit Bangladeshi Muslim community. Those train rides, they didn't last long. Her parents found out. And that's how, at age 10...
My dad was like, if we can't control you, then we're going to get you married in Bangladesh. As a kid back then, I remember staying quiet.
This was not an empty threat.
Growing up, I went to so many weddings where the girl was full on crying, telling her parents, I don't want to get married. I don't want to get married.
Here's the thing Safia wants me to know.
I'm a Brooklynite. You know, I grew up in the hoods.
Safia wants me to know this. She is American, and so is child marriage. To find out more, I turned to Frady Reese. She runs the nonprofit Unchained at Last.
This is happening in nearly every community that you can think of.
When you think of child marriage, you may think of the developing world. Countries like Niger, where 78% of children are married by 18. But a survey by Reese's group, Unchained at Last, found that 250,000 children married in the U.S. between 2000 and 2010.
We've had clients from Jewish, Muslim, and Christian backgrounds who were married as children, and they have come from every socioeconomic level, from both multi-generational American families as well as immigrant families.
Reese and others are pushing hard to change laws across the country. Here in New York, new legislation would raise the age of marriage consent to 17, which Reese says isn't good enough. 17, after all, is still underage. And Reese says age is only part of the problem. She says laws need to tackle all types of arranged marriage. And she speaks from experience. Reese grew up an ultra-Orthodox Hasidic Jew.
My family arranged my marriage when I was 19. So I was not a child, even though I was a teenager. And even at 19, I didn't have agency. I didn't have the ability to say no.
Reese was technically an adult, but one who had spent her whole life not being allowed to drive, have money, have contact with the world outside her community. She was virtually a child. Safia, meanwhile, was able to resist an arranged marriage, but her refusal came at a steep cost. She didn't go into details, but said there was physical and verbal abuse.
There were points where it became so unnecessarily unbearable, where I was like, you know, if I got married, then they'd just leave me alone.
In time, she started going to college on a scholarship. She practically slept on campus. The authorities were alerted, and they stepped in and offered her housing. Today, Safia studies philosophy with an emphasis on Islam. And here's another thing she wants you to know. It was actually Islam that set her free.
One of the reasons that my parents couldn't force me into getting married was I knew my religion. And in my religion, it explicitly says that any marriage that is forced is null and void. And there have been cases in our tradition where a girl has been married without her consent, and she went to the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and told her, you know, my parents forced me into marriage. Am I a married woman? And he said that marriage was not accepted. It was because of my religion that I'm still a single lady. So
after our interview, Safia takes me to the nearest subway stop. On a whim, she hops on with me for a very long ride uptown. She's beaming. She still loves it down here. For The World, Jasmine Garst, New York City.
French police are still investigating a school shooting that took place yesterday in the southeastern town of Grasse. A heavily armed teenager opened fire, wounding three other students and the school's principal. The alleged gunman was reportedly inspired by U.S. school massacres, including the 1999 Columbine school killings. Reporter Adeline Sear is in France. And Adele, France is still in a state of emergency after the series of terror attacks that's taken place there in the last few years. So I imagine news of this shooting must have triggered people's worst fears.
Absolutely. It's almost like the nation held its breath yesterday, as, you know, it almost seems like there was an expectation that he would be a Muslim student, which he was not. It turns out he was the son of a local elected official who had run with the far-right National Front Party. But so yesterday, when one reporter asked witnesses whether the attacker had shouted anything before shooting, it was really clear that he was sort of expecting to hear Allah Akbar or something like that. But obviously, you know, the student replied, no, there was no such cry. And so following this, there were many comments on Twitter and elsewhere about how France has become totally Islamophobic. And it's sad to see, you know, how radical Islam terrorism, in a way, is sort of ingrained into the nation's psyche. You know, one media critic said he sees this as almost like collective hysteria.
Let's go back to the alleged shooter. What do French police know about him?
He's said to be very cooperative with police, and he really sort of said, you know, he had a grudge with a couple of students and he did not want to commit mass murder. He was really after students who he said had harassed him. And we kind of see a profile emerge. I hate to say it, but the standard, you know, vulnerable teenager, weaponized teenage angst in a way. You know, this is what we've seen in the United States over and over again, and it's happening in France as well.
The alleged attacker in yesterday's school shooting in France, he's also been described as being fascinated with violence and U.S. school massacres. Any evidence to support that?
Well, yes, a lot of photos and pictures on his Facebook page, a few of the Columbine massacre. He was apparently fascinated with that, fascinated with weapons, had a lot of violent images. And again, you know, we have seen this before. In France, though, it's very unusual. Weapons are not that readily available in France. So this boy was apparently able to get his father's and grandfather's weapons, which were very dangerous firearms, obviously. And this is very unusual for France as well. I mean, I think fewer than 30% of French people have firearms. So this would be a very unusual occurrence.
I've been reading that the way that the people responded at the school and the principal, as if it was a terrorist incident, in some ways, being prepared for a terrorist event might have helped them in this situation.
Interestingly, I saw a few days ago for the first time a poster that says, you know, what to do in case of a terrorist attack. And I was surprised because I hadn't seen it before, but it must be displayed in schools, police stations. Like, in fact, this one, it was at a train station when I saw it. Here's what to do in case of a terrorist attack. Basically, you have to push heavy furniture against the classroom door, turn off all lights, lay down on the floor, completely silent, turn off cell phones. So it's really much the same thing as what you would do in case of an armed intruder going into the school. Local authorities yesterday said, we have avoided the worst because this school apparently had been drilling its students according to those terrorist attacks guidelines. And so that may have saved the lives of many students in the school.
The principal went in there and just kind of tried to talk the guy down.
Yes, the principal, even after he was shot, confronted the young man. He was very brave, and he probably helped save many lives in this attack yesterday.
Adeline Sear reporting from France. Thanks so much, Adele.
You're welcome.
I'm Carol Hills with The World. As a second-generation Chinese-American, author Gish Jen is well aware of the dangers of stereotyping. But in her latest book, she tackles the notion that a culture gap exists between East and West, the idea that part of the problem lies in the very different Eastern and Western notions of self and identity. The book is called The Girl at the Baggage Claim, and Jen says that title refers to an actual girl.
So this is a girl who was living in Asia. She applied to Milton Academy, which, as you know, is a very prestigious independent school outside of Boston. She had great TOEFL scores. She had great essays. She had a great Skype interview. Milton Academy was very excited about accepting her. They went to the airport to go welcome her. And pretty much right away they realized that something was not quite right. And as the semester went on, it slowly came out that the girl who had arrived was not the girl who had done the Skype interview.
And who was she?
It was her sister. The reason I tell the story is not just because it is an example of fraud. You know, there's a lot of fraud in Asia and elsewhere, right? But because of the particular kind of fraud it was. You know, the type of fraud was a kind that many, many, many heads of schools remarked upon. I mean, they were just shocked, you know. But listening to the story, of course, I recognize that it was wrong. But the type of fraud was not shocking to me.
Why not?
The idea of substituting one person for another, I realized, was very Asian and very common. And as I thought about that, I realized that, oh, there's a whole kind of self. There's an Asian self that is not much understood by the West. And if you understand this self, you will understand that the idea of substitution is not strange. And you will see it, by the way, all the time. I mean, I had a tutor last fall, my Chinese tutor, when I was teaching in Shanghai. My Chinese tutor told me a story where, you know, she had a very good friend who was not very athletic, and their school had a physical fitness requirement. So she did the long jump for her friend. She did this so successfully that her friend was then recruited for track and field. Right?
So in the case of the girl who's not the right girl who shows up at Milton,
right,
and the case of your friend who stands in for her friend to do the long jump,
right,
how is it seen as not cheating?
It's seen as a bad thing. I mean, like, you know, it's a wink, wink, but it's seen as something that is like speeding. If you go 75 in a 65 mile an hour speed zone, right, that's a bad thing. And you do get your ticket, but it's not the end of the world. And what I'm trying to say is for them, they understand that it's wrong, but it's not taboo.
Why not?
And it's not taboo because the underlying self is different. So we have all these things which, you know, which are wrong and taboo. There's a cultural mandate that tells us we must be different. You know, our uniqueness is not just a fact of life, but sacred. In China, they understand that people are unique, but they don't see it as a sacred fact about your existence. You know, it's simply true. People are different. Of course, they're different.
But in the case of the two examples you mentioned, there's consequences for the substitution. I mean, if the substitution happened in China with the standing in for your friend to do the long jump, that's one thing. But hit Milton, I'm sure the student was sent home.
Yes. They have a different sense of self. And if you imagine that in the West, we have a view of the self as being like an avocado, so we have a big pit. And, you know, a bit unavoidable, but we imagine that everybody must have a pit like that, right? This pit is a sacred pit, and, you know, and so much of our ideas about education and everything else have to do with taking good care of this pit and making sure this pit can express itself and so on and so forth. And we imagine that that's true of everyone in the world. But it's not true of everyone in the world. Quite the contrary. It's view of a very, very, very small number of people. And the vast majority of the world have what I call a flexi self. So they do not have this big pit in the middle. And, you know, they're much more oriented toward their group, their religion, their tradition, something outside themselves. It's not that they're not different, right? If you looked at their DNA, of course they're different. But if you ask them, well, where does real truth lie? You know, where is truth, capital T? You know, the truth that you must really heed, that is not inside but outside. And therefore, you know, a group like a family group, they see themselves as kind of like a relay team. You know, the same way that you might sub in another runner if somebody was injured, they have a much more interchangeable view of themselves than we have in the West.
But I wonder if, you know, through all this kind of delineation of these, you know, two approaches, which of course are not concrete. There's lots of variations.
Of course.
But how does the notion of an independent self, a sort of avocado pit versus an interdependent flexi self, how do you see that expressing itself in the very impassioned debate we have today in the U.S. about immigration?
I would argue that actually many of these immigrants are coming with a flexi self background. One of the implications of that is that actually they perceive things differently than the individualistic self, the big pig self. Big pig self, if you give them a picture of a lion and a savannah, they see the lion. The flexi self, you know, given a picture of a lion and a savannah, they see the savannah. Well, if you have given any problem or any matter, of course you would want to have people with both ways of perceiving, right? Obviously, that is very much to your advantage. It's to our advantage as a nation. And therefore, I think it's not at all surprising, especially when their children acquire a big pit self so that they have both selves. It's not surprising that that is a very, very powerful thing. I think I just saw the numbers, the Intel Science Talent Search. 83% of those kids are second generation, children of immigrants. You know, my argument in favor of immigrants, well, like, why would you not want these people to come to our country producing, not only generating huge energy in that first generation, but producing these second generation kids who are going to fuel all of our scientific research and much, much more?
I have to ask you, the viral video that occurred with a BBC reporter, he's trying to do his report and his wife comes in, the kids come in, she runs in to tries to pull them out. And, you know, it went viral, everybody saw it, and everybody kind of had their own idea of what had happened there. What did you make of the reaction to that video? And does it tell us about our own ideas of the self?
Well, yeah, you know, the fact of the matter is when we see this guy sitting there, you know, giving his report, you know, in general, when we see a figure like that, we imagine that that he has no strings. Do you know what I mean? That he has no responsibilities. We see him as a lone individual speaking to us. And we don't see the truth of the matter is of course he is attached to a million other people in a million ways, right? But we don't see that, and moreover, we don't really want to see it, right? I mean, we don't want to think about him that way. And I think to think about him that way is to see him as a person with diminished authority, right? I think to us, you know, the person that we really want to hear from in the West is completely free, right? He's free of all those attachments. But actually, there is no such person. I mean, that is our fantasy.
Gish Jen's new book is called The Girl at the Baggage Claim, Explaining the East-West Culture Gap. Thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
I'm Carol Hills. Ari Beezer's grandfather flew on both of the planes that dropped atomic bombs on Japan. Now the grandson's dedicated to telling the victims' stories.
What I really want to learn is what it was like for the people underneath the mushroom cloud, the people that, the women and the children.
Understanding Hiroshima, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. The United States gave a blunt warning to North Korea today.
Let me be very clear. The policy of strategic patience has ended. We're exploring a new range of diplomatic, security, and economic measures. All options are on the table.
That's Secretary of State Rex Tillerson speaking in Seoul, South Korea. He went on to make clear what the U.S. expected of the North.
North Korea must understand that the only path to a secure, economically prosperous future is to abandon its development of nuclear weapons, ballistic missiles, and other weapons of mass destruction.
It wasn't quite an ultimatum, but Tillerson made it clear the U.S. is ready for military action, possibly even preemptive action. Isaac Stonefish is a journalist and senior fellow at the Asia Society. Isaac, are we really talking about the U.S. considering military action against North Korea?
Certainly seems like they're trying to make the point that that option is on the table. And if they did decide for a military strike, there's ways that the United States could do that without provoking a response that's tantamount to a declaration of war from North Korea.
And what kind of attack would that look like?
So they could do something where they very symbolically take out a particular North Korean military site that's not that important, but sends a strong message. Or if they really wanted to send a very important symbolic message, they could, for example, bomb a statue of Kim Il-sung, the grandfather of the current leader, Kim Jong-un, and a beloved former president of North Korea. There's thousands of those statues around North Korea. Or they could also bomb a villa that Kim Jong-un is not in, but just a way of showing displeasure with what the North Koreans are doing.
But couldn't the North then retaliate and take it out on South Korea, which could then just escalate things into the stratosphere?
They certainly could, but North Korea really doesn't want to provoke war. The best description I've heard for North Korea's negotiating tactics is picture a robber who walks up to you, points a gun at his own head, and says, "Stop or I'll shoot." the most painful thing that North Korea can do to the rest of the world, and especially to China, is to collapse, because that would be a massive crisis for the countries in the region, and China would have to be taking the brunt of that. So what North Korea loves to do is take things to right below the boiling point. So they, if something like that, if the U.S. did a aggressive military action like that, that was a notch down from a declaration of war, North Korea would try to meet the distance between what a declaration is and where they are. So, for example, like they did several years ago, they could shell a South Korean island. They could launch a ballistic missile closer to the United States, but far enough away that the United States would realize that it's not going to hit or not aimed for continental United States or Alaska.
It all sounds like a very high-stakes game to be playing these days in terms of this new U.S. More aggressive approach to North Korea. I mean, do you think that something could go wrong and we could really find ourselves in a military mess in Korea?
Yes, that is certainly possible. I think it's quite unlikely. And I think that's luckily not in any of the country's interests, but we're talking very difficult calculations here, and it's certainly possible that Pyongyang miscalculates or the United States miscalculates, and we find ourselves in a situation that's very difficult to de-escalate.
Isaac Stonefish, journalist and senior fellow at the Asia Society. Thanks, Isaac.
Thank you, Carol.
It's hard to think about the threat of nuclear war without remembering the U.S. bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki during World War II. The destruction wrought on those Japanese cities still reverberates today, sometimes in surprising ways. This is a story of one remarkable friendship that grew out of the devastation. Here's the world's Daniel Gross.
Ari Beezer is 28 and grew up in Baltimore. But in recent years, he's traveled 5 times to Japan. He made those trips in part because he wanted to understand his grandfather.
Because his image is so ingrained in my mind, it makes me feel like I know him. But he passed away when I was 4, so I don't have too many memories. More recollections of what it felt like to be with him.
Ari's grandfather was Jacob Beezer, who served in World War II. Ari has a black and white photo from 1945. Beezer is standing in his Air Force uniform in front of a huge plane, the Enola Gay.
On August 6, 1945... at precisely 8:15 in the morning, I was on a B-29 four-engine bomber.
This is Jacob Beezer. He was the only man in the world to fly on both planes that dropped nuclear bombs in Japan. He was manning the radar.
I never saw the intact city of Hiroshima. And when I got to the window, all I saw was this boiling, muddy mess with fires continuing to break out on the periphery.
My grandfather disconnected with what happened. He said that his immediate reaction was that it looked like when you go down to the ocean shore and you kick up the sand in the tide and the sand billows in the water.
When you hear that scene of your grandfather flying toward Hiroshima, can you imagine it?
Well, you know, I mean, the hardest part for me to imagine is that he was 24 years old when he did it. That's crazy. He was basically a kid.
Ari was 23 when he first visited Japan. In March 2011, he got a grant to write about the legacy of nuclear weapons in Hiroshima. The timing was uncanny. The day Ari got the grant, a tsunami struck Fukushima nuclear power plant. He decided to go anyway because nuclear technology in Japan was more relevant than ever. The trip changed the course of his life. One of the things Ari wanted to know was how his grandfather ended up in that plane over Hiroshima. That story began in the 1930s. Jacob Beezer was a Jewish teenager in Baltimore.
You know, he said he had like 20 brothers and sisters. That's what he always said, because my great-grandmother had been taking in German refugee children.
The Beezer family had Jewish relatives in Europe. Jacob Beezer wanted to go there and fight.
He was trying to enlist and fight Nazis. My great-grandmother wouldn't let him. She said, You're a good Jewish boy. The war is no place for a good Jewish boy.
She kept saying that until 1941.
A date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
Beezer went to boot camp, but he was good at math, so he was sent to Florida to study radar. He was too late for the war in Europe, and instead he was tapped for a secret mission that was supposed to end the war in Japan. His superiors wouldn't say what it was.
They never said the word nuclear. They never said they were building an atomic bomb.
Beezer's next post was in Los Alamos, New Mexico. And after the U.S. completed its first nuclear bombs, Beezer was selected to help fly them to Japan. When Ari flew to Japan in 2011, he was retracing the path that his grandfather once took. In Hiroshima, he was surrounded by people his grandfather might have considered enemies.
In the city that, if I went 70 years ago, I could have been killed just for being American.
He stayed for months in Japan. He started to learn Japanese. And Ari turned out to be the kind of person who needs to know more.
What I really want to learn is what it was like for the people underneath the mushroom cloud, the people that, the women and the children that were mostly there.
There are still thousands of living atomic bomb survivors, hibakusha, as they're called in Japanese. One day, Ari went to a lecture by a woman named Keiko Ogura.
I try to forget those days because that's a horrible memory, and time to time when I recall those days, sometimes I cried.
Ogura has worked as a volunteer translator for her fellow hibakusha. She knows how hard it is for them to share. There's not only trauma, but also stigma. Some Japanese people viewed radiation sickness as contagious. Others assumed children of survivors would be born with defects.
Many survivors do not want to talk even to our children. I didn't tell my story to my children.
You never told your story to your children?
I didn't. They learned by themselves, or they heard from somebody else. So many years, more than 50 years, I think, I didn't talk about myself. But I thought I have to tell, I have to do something, because people do not know about Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
I asked Ogura if she felt comfortable sharing her memories. She said yes. On the night of August 5th, 1945, Ogura was a little girl living a couple miles from the city center. The family kept waking up to the sound of sirens. It seemed like planes were flying overhead, but no bombs were falling.
Then we tried to sleep. Again, another warning. Nothing happened. So that was so strange. During the night, so many times, so there was warning, but nothing happened.
The next morning, Ogura's father felt worried. He told Ogura not to go into the city for school.
I was on the road near my house, and all of a sudden, there was a tremendously bright flash, and I couldn't stand. I was hit on the road and became unconscious.
When she woke up, it was so dark, she thought it was evening.
But all of a sudden, I heard somebody was crying. That was my little brother. So I waited for a while, and by, I could see my neighborhood.
It started to rain. The droplets were black and stained her blouse. There were wounded and dying people all around. And when some of them asked for water, she gave it to them. She wanted to be helpful. Some of those people died.
I thought that was my fault. And I blamed myself so many years. I saw very dreadful nightmare, 20 years or so more. I had a hard time.
For decades, Ogura didn't want to recall the events of that day. Her story was a burden, but she also realized it had a special power to change people's minds, to inspire young people like Ari Beezer. Ogura's story made Ari think about his grandfather, Jacob Beezer, who was far above the carnage in that B-29. Beezer helped found Sandia National Laboratories after the war, and then worked as an engineer for military contractors. He didn't feel remorse for what happened. Ari wondered how his grandfather might have reacted to stories of survivors in Japan, like Ogura. When she finished her lecture, 6 years ago, He went up and introduced himself.
I actually did not know who this young man was.
Ari and Ogura have been in touch ever since, and they recently agreed to let me record them talking on the phone. Thinking back, Ari remembers wishing, in that first meeting, that someone had given her a heads up about who he was.
I was embarrassed that no one had explained to you beforehand, because you would be maybe surprised to know that instead of a regular American boy, you were talking to the grandson of someone who was on the airplanes, someone who was above the mushroom cloud.
But Ogura was excited and a little worried that Ari would be upset.
I felt so sorry. Ari might be shocked. Ari, didn't you feel like that? Weren't you shocked?
Well, I mean, it's more amazing to me that you were more worried about how I would feel than how you felt. All you were worried about was somebody else. That just speaks to how great you are, Ogura-san.
Ogura-san, when you met Ari, did you also feel any pain or any anger?
Anger? No. Because Ari is a young American boy. I thought American young people should know what happened in reality.
That meeting made Ari committed to hearing and sharing stories of survivors. He met with Ogura many more times, even shared the stage with her. She started to call him grandson. And in 2015, Ari published a book about all this. It's called The Nuclear Family. In 2016, President Barack Obama visited the Hiroshima Peace Park. He met survivors, and he prayed with Japan's Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe. Ari was in attendance and remembers having a kind of revelation.
And I realized that one day that I'm going to tell my grandchildren that my grandfather was the only man in the world that flew on both the planes that dropped the atomic bombs, and their grandfather saw the first U.S. president come to Hiroshima. And to me, that's the definition of peace.
Ari remembers seeing Ogura that day, too. They were happy.
She'd said to me, your grandfather was above the mushroom cloud, and I was under the mushroom cloud, but we can be together.
For The World, I'm Daniel Gross.
Daniel's story is part of a series we're doing on nuclear history and the relationships of the atomic age. You can find more stories at pri.org/nuclearfamily. I'm Carol Hills with The World. A bit frosty today in Washington, at least where U.S.-German relations are concerned. Chancellor Angela Merkel went to the White House for her first face-to-face meeting with President Trump. You might recall candidate Trump was very critical of Merkel during the campaign. Today, he greeted the German chancellor with a handshake, but then during a photo op, the two leaders did not shake hands. Away from the cameras, Trump and Merkel talked about a lot of topics, from trade to anti-terrorism efforts. Later at a joint press conference, Trump shared what he told Merkel about NATO. That's the military alliance that binds the U.S. and Europe, an alliance Trump has criticized in the past.
I reiterated to Chancellor Merkel my strong support for NATO, as well as the need for our NATO allies to pay their fair share for the cost of defense. Many nations owe vast sums of money from past years, and it is very unfair to the United States. These nations must pay what they owe.
Chancellor Merkel acknowledged that Germany and other European nations need to increase their defense spending. Later, a German reporter asked Merkel what she made of Trump's isolationist trade policies. Before the German leader could answer, Trump jumped in.
Well, first of all, I don't believe in an isolationist policy. But I also believe a policy of trade should be a fair policy. And the United States has been treated very, very unfairly by many countries over the years, and that's going to stop. But I'm not an isolationist. I'm a free trader, but I'm also a fair trader.
For her part, Merkel emphasized that trade agreements are supposed to benefit both sides.
We have underlined as German industry, German business community, and have made the experience that any kind of agreement that we have concluded, for example, at the very latest with South Korea, brought us more jobs, actually. People were very much concerned about losing jobs, for example, the automotive industry, but in the end, it turned out, particularly as regards South Korea, in the end, it turned out that both sides benefited. And I think it's only fair. That's the purpose of concluding agreements, that both sides win.
Before the press conference was over, another German journalist asked Trump about wiretapping. What did the president have to say about his unsubstantiated allegations that President Obama wiretapped Trump Tower during the campaign? Trump didn't answer that directly. Instead, he resurrected the old controversy about the NSA spying on Merkel during the Obama administration.
As far as wiretapping, I guess, by, you know, this past administration, at least we have something in common, perhaps.
President Trump speaking at a joint press conference this afternoon with German Chancellor Angela Merkel. Finally today, a story about some kids breaking down borders, at least virtually. Austin, Texas is playing host to the annual South by Southwest conference. It's full of film, music, and media, and lots of people looking to network and connect. This year, that includes some Texas students linking up with kids in Mexico City. Ari Daniel has our story from Austin.
Several kids, all in elementary school in Austin, strain against a thick black rope. They pull with everything they've got.
I got this!
The rope disappears into a giant blue box where a machine's measuring the force the kids are pulling with. That's relayed in real time to a matching setup in Mexico City, where a handful of Mexican kids are pulling back on an identical black rope. The two groups are locked in a physical/virtual game of tug-of-war. Mexico wins this round. Mounted on the blue box in Mexico City and the blue box back here in Austin is a big screen tied to a webcam showing who's on the other side of the rope. This game, called Tug of Hope, was designed by a team at the ad agency FCB, headed up by creative director Humberto Polar, who wanted to bring kids together.
Playing is a way of making friends, losing prejudices, and knowing how to learn about other cultures and respect them.
Noble. So I spoke to kids on both sides to see whether the game achieved its goal. Leslie Parks is 9 years old.
It's almost like there's a big, long rope underground to Mexico City.
Did you feel like you were kind of closer to the kids in Mexico through this activity?
You don't know them, so maybe, like, you need to say, hi, do you want to be friends? Or it's like, I think you need to say your name, because then they don't know you, and, like, they'll probably never see you again.
In Mexico City, the Tug of Hope was installed at the Papalote Children's Museum, and 10-year-old Hanna Rocha got to play. She says that despite living in different places, the American kids and the Mexican kids aren't different. They're connected, she says. 9-year-old Sara Isabella Barajas Cruz agrees. She says kids are equal because we're all human.
We all have the same hairstyle. We may have the same type of clothes on.
This is Leslie Parks back in Austin again.
I think the whole purpose is to have fun with other people around the world.
In fact, the organizers do want to introduce kids in more countries to Tug of Hope, to unite them as one, just like today. Patriotic cheering notwithstanding. Fatima Isabel Osorio played the game on the Mexico side. The visceral connection to Texas made her think of her uncle, who lives in the U.S., north of her border.
Un saludo para mi tío que está allá. Pues, yo no lo veo, lo extraño mucho.
She says she doesn't get to see him, and she misses him. If you're listening, she says, I'm sending you a kiss. For the World, Ari Daniel, Austin.
By the way, the World's Marco Werman is in Austin, Texas right now. He's there for a special South by Southwest music showcase our show's a part of. It's called Contraband, Music Unites. That's spelled Contra, B-A-N-N-E-D. It features six musicians with roots in countries targeted by President Trump's travel ban executive orders. You can read more about tonight's showcase over at the World's Facebook page. And we'll hear from some of the musicians when Marco's back on Monday. Right now, we'll leave with music from a duo performing tonight. Here's Faro, two sisters originally from Somalia, now making music in L.A. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. Have a great weekend. If I start a riot, will you
PRI, Public Radio International.